Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. There are so many prisoners who have had so many goals in their lives to become someone, anyone, and everyone would be proud to know and befriend. Someone every parent would be proud of. However, one mistake can destroy any opportunity or hope to fulfill those dreams. And we all know when someone has stumbled, they soon find out that those individuals who they once thought were their friends or family are simply no longer interested in being associated with them. We also know the media portrays someone who unfortunately makes a mistake, not taking into consideration that there are always two sides to every story. We're going to have on with us a little later on this morning Thomas Dormer, a 27-year-old man who had goals since a very young age to become a professional soccer player. Thomas was on with us yesterday, and he spoke briefly about a lot of the things that he did go through prior to, during, and after he came out. However, the one mistake in his life resulted in his shattered dreams and 4 years of incarceration. Today, he's going to be talking about his current plans, which you may say were put on hold and are now being worked on once again. But I wanted to talk about these kind of things because there are so many people in the prisons today who did have goals, many of them who didn't even have anyone supporting them psychologically or financially, spiritually, or anything, and they still struggle to get somewhere. There have been many, not only women, but men, who have been lied to and deceived by either family members, in-laws, strangers, or maybe a first-time relationship, even in some cases, second or third. But we have prisoners who are now serving life and life without parole for these kind of issues. And it's sad because everyone deserves to have a chance to make something of themselves. There was one prisoner in court who had shot someone. And this was many, many years ago. He's been in for 24 years now. He had goals and was lied to and deceived, not only by someone in a first-time relationship, but also by a family member, an uncle-in-law. And this uncle-in-law is still out of the prison and has abused other children. This is sad because so many people who cause prisoners to fall are still walking the streets. Well, these unfortunate cases of single young men or women who work so hard to make something of themselves are sent to prison. These are some of the things we want to consider when looking at prisoners. First, we do not want to stereotype prisoners. Second, we want to try to understand what caused them to fall. And thirdly, we want to help them to try to reform or rehabilitate. In the prisons today, they are not really rehabilitating anyone. Prisoners are rehabilitating themselves. They are coming out of prison with their goals once again. So we have on with us this morning Thomas Dormer to talk about his current plans, what he is doing. And we're honored to have him on with us because Thomas is one of many, although many cannot speak. Thomas is a voice for many of the incarcerated that went through exactly what he's gone through. And Thomas, are you on with us now?
I am.
Okay, I'm glad to have you on with us once again. I'm really honored to have you on. And I'll tell you, Thomas, this was posted all over Facebook, and there have been so many people who have been liking the posting and everything else. So I'm hoping that we are going to have some callers coming on. I know some said they would be. So, but briefly, if you can, just go over briefly what you spoke about yesterday, and I'd like to know more about what your plans are. I know you're heading towards the right direction and fulfilling your dreams, and we hope that comes true, too.
Okay, thank you for having me on again. Briefly, what I spoke about yesterday was just a little bit of my beginning of, you know, I had a kind of roughhouse brought up, but I never got in trouble with the law. I was a pretty decent kid. honor roll. I had some scholarships for sports, and I was a firefighter, the youngest firefighter ever in our city. And, you know, a couple complications where I was just really immature. You know, my fiance cheated on me. I lost all my friends. My mom got cancer. Kind of just gave up. 2 weeks later, I did an armed robbery with a fake gun. Not with the intention, you know, the intention to get the money, but just kind of gave up. And then, you know, just made a horrible choice. And I've been living with it ever since. Kind of found out about the system. I had to basically fight for my life. My city had my back. And then when I went to prison, I kind of walked a path where I was constantly reminded nobody else has really kind of walked my path with my skin color, my background, where I'm from, and just being extremely new to the system, knowing nothing about it. And then, you know, I served 4 years from 19 to 23. I was prepared to come out and, you know, come out and live the dream that I've been working at for so long. And I came out, and there's been a lot of complications and a lot of bumps in the road since I'm out here. But I've been very blessed in life to have a good support system. So now I'm finally seeing dividends in my life.
That is awesome. That is really awesome. And you said yesterday, I believe you started out very young wanting to be a professional soccer player.
Yes. From the minute I touched the ball, I was 6 years old. Me and my best friend started playing when we were six. And we played, you know, on every team until we were 18. And we had high aspirations. And I never could reach my full potential. I had a lot of things going on in life. I love soccer. But soccer was the only place where, you know, when I went to practice and I went played games, I could kind of zone out everything. I could get all my stress out on the game. And it was the greatest alternative for me. It kept me out of trouble, kept me on a straight, narrow road for most of my life. And for the first time when I quit soccer, 2 weeks later, I was facing 130 years in prison. I got bitter. So I've always kind of wanted to live out that dream of going, you know, pro or going playing at a high level in college and seeing what next step holds.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned yesterday you have five dogs. And I know this sounds kind of crazy, but I know in many prisons around the country, they have dog training. But only a certain amount of people, they're limited as to who can actually train dogs. I find that music, soft music and animals are one of the greatest assets to healing someone. What are your thoughts on having more dogs brought into the prisons and having more dogs trained by prisoners?
I think there's a need for it. In Wisconsin, there's actually one prison that I know about only. It's a work release minimum. So you're able to go out in the community, but you're also able to train dogs as well. It's only one. There's only, I think, 20, 30, 40 spots out of, you know, all the thousands of people in there. So it's very limited, less than 1%. But I think they work because, you know, the biggest issue is when you're in prison, as weird as it seems, you can stay a little bit more focused on your goals. You don't have to worry about so much. You know, there's a lot going on, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it's kind of easy to wake up and be on your schedule and know, you know, this is what I'm doing at this time and talking about, you know, what you're going to do when you get out and, you know, how you feel towards the people that are forgetting about you right now. You have that little chip on your shoulder. And sometimes when you get out, you know, it's easier to forgive people. It's easier to let your guard down and let these people that weren't there for you back in your lives and get distracted. And, you know, like I said, I served 19 to 23, so I missed my 21, and I turned 21 on a Saturday. So instead of going out to the bars, I never got to experience that in my life. So, you know, that was a little distraction when I got out. I always wanted to, you know, go out to the bars or have a drink or do something like that. And right away when I got out, you get drawn to different, you know, different parties and going out on the weekend and doing things that might not necessarily be horrible for you, but they're putting you in bad situations. And dogs were just an alternative for me. I just started staying at home a lot, and I was really bored at home. And I just thought about, you know, who else is forgotten about. And I started working at a humane shelter. and I just seen these dogs. These workers didn't put any time into them. They didn't. Their cards just had a name on them that they came up with, but there's nothing about these dogs, so they weren't getting adopted. And most of them were pit bulls, and I would work with them, and they would be the greatest dogs in the world. They just needed a little exercise. They needed a little chance. So I was like, you know, I could relate to them. So I was like, you know, I was thinking long term. I needed a couple surgeries. I had my rotator cuff and my labrum put back together. And I was like, you know what, I might as well get some dogs. I already had one at the time. So I ended up getting another one, pit bull. And they just, you know, they took up a lot of my time, and they were a reason to come home. I worked 8 in the morning till 6 at night, and I had to get up at 5 every morning to run my dogs to make sure that they got their energy, you know, out so they weren't pent up all day. And then when I came home, you know, right away after a 10-hour shift, I was working at a car wash for $9. And it was winter time, and I would be cold and wet all day, but I would have to come home, and my priorities, instead of like laying down or being lazy, my dogs would instantly, you know, welcome me and make me feel loved. But, you know, they were horrible if you didn't run them and you didn't exercise them, you know, but that's all they needed. They just needed a little love and exercise, and they were the greatest things to come home to. So they just kept me on my schedule. They kept me, you know, coming home. I didn't have a choice to go out to work, you know, after work. I didn't have a choice to go hang out with my friends for a few hours. My dogs were already in a bedroom for 10 hours. So they just, they made me come home. And the biggest thing coming home was getting that chunk of time. You know, at the end of the day, you're released and you're free, but it's not just, you know, you're free. You're basically starting over again, a whole nother bit. You're starting over with something new. And, you know, I just think, you know, being back at home is the safest place. And, you know, just, it still gave me that time to look at myself in the mirror, think about all the goals, think about, you know, how I was going to go about them, and just keep building up time and time underneath my belt.
I'll tell you, honestly, just listening to you, Thomas, is so interesting because, first of all, you speak very well. Secondly, you have such compassion in the way you speak. I mean, not just speaking about your dogs, but just in general, you seem like you've gone through so much for your young 27 years, and you've gone through so much, and you, at the same time, you were always there. You always had that stability in you, making one mistake, you know, to take away from your goals. And as I say, it wasn't that it was taken away. It was just put on hold for a while. But I always say, spell dog backwards, and you have God. God is in control. He's in control of the animals. He's in control of you and all of us. But I believe strongly that animals are an asset to people, especially when it comes to needing that support. Now, when you went to prison, it was very devastating for you, as you mentioned yesterday, because it was the first time for you. And you mentioned even contemplating suicide and some of these things. You said you saw a lot of deaths in the prison. Was it because of suicides, or was it because of homicides? Because not all prisoners are like you or others, but there are some that are pretty bad because they haven't had that bringing up, that support, you know. And there's a lot of them that are so full of anger that, you know, they're ready to just let it all out, leash it all out on anyone. But there's also a lot of good prisoners in there. When you were in there, you mentioned that you saw a lot of people die. And was that from homicides or suicides or both?
Well, the majority was suicides. You know, the state of Wisconsin, it's a little different prison system. It's a lot more mentality over, you know, the inmates running the prison and all that other stuff. It's mental. You know, you're basically locked in a cage a lot of the times, and you're not allowed out. So a lot of people I've seen commit suicide for sure. And it was pretty rough. It was terrifying. You know, whoever says, you know, going to prison for the first time isn't terrifying is lying. My first day that I went to prison, like I said, I was out on bail and I got sentenced. So I had to walk back to county jail, and I was back there for 10 days, and everybody kept saying, oh, you know, you're going to like prison better than jail. You're going to like prison better than jail. And I thought they were crazy. I was like, you know, no way. And, you know, the very first day I went to prison, I rode on the bus, and, you know, there's still a few things that give me, like, PTSD, or I can't get out of my mind, and it was the shackles on the way to the prison. Every time we went over a bump, you heard that, you know, and it still sat with me, you know, not the cell door closing, not anything. It was those shackles that I couldn't get out of my mind for years. And I was the last one to get on the bus because I didn't want to go. They forced me to get on the bus, so that means I was the first one to get off the bus. And when we pulled up to the prison, it was finally time. And I still remember I wouldn't get out of the bus. I was just sitting there. I didn't say anything. I just kept looking, and they were, you know, the guards were yelling like, "Hey, you know, you got to get out. You got to get out." And I wouldn't move. And they grabbed my shackles and threw me on the ground because I wouldn't move. And you know, there's a couple guys on the bus like, you know, "Damn, you know, you're scared as fuck to be in here." And I was just looking around. I was ready to go. It was a weird feeling, and that's how I got my nickname, because I have a Pittsburgh Steel City tattooed on my arm. It was my newest tattoo. I never wanted a visible tattoo, but I got one, so everybody started calling me Pittsburgh, and that was my nickname for 4 years. I got it right away. They were like, "Pitt, don't worry about it. Pittsburgh, don't worry about it." And I just had an older gentleman come up to me, look at me, and we were all in the cell. We finally had our shackles off, and he just looked at me, and he just said, "You know, how many years you have?" And I said, "4." And he was like, "Well, you better get used to this. You know, at the end of the day, you're not going home. This is your home for 4 years. You know, you have to prepare yourself, man. This is prison." So it was just terrifying, and it was rough as far as the first time. I can't really remember the second question you had.
You know, I was going to say real quickly too. You mentioned post-traumatic stress. You have that. You mentioned that.
Yeah, for sure.
And the reason I say that is because I believe there's a lot of prisoners that are in prison have that PTSD, and especially going through what you went through. But what I was going to say is most prisoners are being diagnosed, and I don't agree with it, and I don't think it's right that they should be diagnosed with antisocial behavior, because there's a difference between post-traumatic stress disorder and also antisocial. But that's a major thing in the prisons as well that I've been hearing from a lot of prisoners. They're diagnosed with that. But you had mentioned your dogs, coming home to your dogs and being in the house for 10 hours. So, you know how it is for your dogs to be inside for 10 hours, and you had to come home and let them out and give them that attention. What do you think about the solitary confinement? Because this is a major issue which has caused so many, not only when they come out of solitary to commit suicide, but it's been a major issue in affecting them psychologically. What are your thoughts on solitary confinement? Because this is something that so many people out there are trying to stop, while the prison system is trying to maintain that yeah. barbaric attitude about solitary being necessary.
Well, the first thing I can say is, at the end of the day, we're all human beings. At the end of the day, we're human beings, and I'm not an advocate for every single human being in prison. I'll be the first one to say that. Like I said, there were every day I woke up and I looked at people where I was like, "Damn, you know, I realize why you are not in society, why you cannot make it in society." Some people just don't have hope. You know, that just is what it is. And prison is a very controversial topic because, you know, a lot of times you do negative things to get you in there. And, you know, people don't feel sorry for you, and they just think that you do, you know, your short time and you come home. But at the same time, we're human beings, and, you know, if we're talking about changing anything or helping out anybody through this system, we're talking about the people that have hope, the people that can still amount to something in this world. And you're throwing these human beings that still have little hope, still can have value and something to bring to this world, and you're throwing them in with people that don't have value and people that don't care about the world and people that are never going home and really – bad people, and you're throwing these same people just in a box. And at the end of the day, if you throw most human beings in a box, something's going to happen to you. It's just the way of life. You know, your brain's going to think differently. You're going to have to alter the way that your normal thoughts are, and I guess, quote unquote, what normal human beings aren't made to be thrown in a box and made to see people committing suicide and made to hear, you know, these thoughts that other people are thinking. And they're just not, you know, my first cellie I had, he was facing the first cellie. Thankfully, I wrote a journal my whole bit, and I saved every single, that was one thing about me. The COs even tried to get my journal for a couple years because I logged everything, and prison has cameras, so I expect to make it one day, and I expect my story to be told. And I logged every single day, every single thing I seen, every single time. And I think I had 43 total cellies in 4 years, and I logged every single one of their names, their nicknames, what they looked like, tattoos, what they were in there for, and then a little bit about, you know, how our time was as being cellmates. Thankfully, I started that my first couple of days after being locked up. And you're not made for that. Human beings aren't made for that. But at the same time, instead of looking at everything negative, I've always looked at the positive before the negative. I've always really thought about, if somebody can not only just survive, not only just wake up and go to bed every day in prison, but thrive in it, you know, be one of these silverbacks that, you know, these rappers talk about and these people talk about, of going to hell on earth, and not only going to hell on earth, you know, being somebody that brings hope in there, being somebody that still got value, being a big role model. I think that you have an advantage over most people when you get out, as long as you put the pieces together. You are so different mentally than these people. You're able to overcome things that for the rest of your life are going to feel a lot easier than, you know, things you had to overcome in there. So I definitely don't agree with segregation, but at the same time, it's necessary for certain things. I just don't agree how it is. You know, you can't put somebody in segregation for 3 months, 4 months at a time for an argument or for little things like that. I went for in prison, and I seen my best friends go for in prison. These COs, at the end of the day, it's a government job. You know, they have a pension, they get paid, you know, salary. At the end of the day, we understand that they have a very difficult job, but there's no training as far as like working with inmates or having bosses or any personality training. You just need a high school diploma to be, you know, have this career. And these guys and these women come in and they treat you like dirt. They, you know, they treat you less than a human being and an inferior human being every day, day in and day out. And at the end of the day, a human being can only take so much, and there's just no alternatives there for you guys to basically relieve stress. You know, the rec is ran a certain way, and everything's ran. And like I said, I just don't think it's right that, you know, they just look at the whole prison population as one. You know, they need to spend a little bit more time. Like, oh, this guy's going home in a year. You know, this guy has this certain crime. Maybe we shouldn't put him in segregation with a guy that still has 30 years left and has stabbed 10 people in the last couple years, you know. And that's what they do. And they don't really think twice about it. And it ruins the good population. I've seen a lot of people where they still have hope, and every single day it's slowly stripped from them.
Exactly. No. I've heard that from so many prisoners. And another thing is the prison guards, I can imagine what it's like to have a prisoner in there like you, someone with education that's where they don't have it. As you mentioned, a lot of these prison guards are taken off the street. Anyone can apply. And there's prisoners inside that are very intelligent that have made their first mistakes, their only mistakes, like yourself. And I'm sure that the prison guards and officials don't like things like that as well. And then there are some that have actually had to file lawsuits against the prison officials or guards, who then they're at risk of being retaliated against and targeted, which a lot of prisoners are. But these are some of the things. And the reason I ask about solitary is because I know they say terrorists and serial killers, people like that, or even people that are continuously being a problem, violent problem in the prison, I can see putting them in prison for a certain length of time. But some of these prisoners are being put in prison for refusing to be double-celled. Some of them are being put in prison in solitary because there might be a fight on the block and they're not willing to, or they don't know what's going on, and they're called down to tell what they've seen. And some prisoners don't even want to get involved because they weren't involved and they don't want to look as though they are a snitch. A lot of these things they're being put in solitary for, and I don't think it's right because, again, they don't have anything to read. They don't have anything to watch. You know, it's just those four walls, and I think that's so detrimental to harming their psychological welfare.
I agree as well. And I've always said this to all my friends and to all everybody around me. And I just said, you know, if it's hard for me, I can't imagine how hard it is for somebody of color, somebody going back to the hood. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine how they would survive. And we're starting to finally realize that in 2020 that it's almost impossible. I mean, you can still get locked up, go back to prison for allegations. I know people where, you know, I'm reading their paperwork and it's just an allegation. And thankfully, I was me, and I was blessed with the support system I had. Even in prison, it got to the point where after a couple of years, I pushed everything. I never got mistreated by the guards, and every time I did, I mean, don't get me wrong, I did, but I pushed back. I've always fought for myself. I always stood up for myself. I wrote the wardens. I had my people call the newspapers. I had the people call my warden, and after a couple of years, they finally were like, you know, the captain would come on the unit after they would try to put me in segregation, and the captain would be like, listen, what is it for? Oh, it's for this. Leave them alone. You know, because I would have so much people call the prisons and certain things about how we're treated. And I filed a sexual assault against a correctional officer my last year for watching me shower. He came in the showers, which he wasn't supposed to. They had him on camera. They brought down an investigation unit. And I pressed charges against him. They told me that he was found guilty for sexual assault. He wasn't able to do that. They had him on camera. And he left our prison for the last few months. And the whole time he left, he was at another prison. We had other guys write us that he was over there. And the minute I left the prison, the minute I finally got released, he was able to go back to work at the same prison. He's still there. And it's the only job probably in America where you can get found guilty for sexually assaulting somebody at your workplace and still have a career, still not miss your pension, and still not miss a paycheck. And that's a big issue for me. Same thing with segregation. It's the only place where, you know, the good thing is everything is logged, and I don't like to speak up too much because one day my voice is going to carry a lot of value, and one day I'm going to speak up and have everything looked at with a fine-tooth comb. And the one good thing about prison is everything has to be logged and everything is on camera. So when they break the rules and somebody eventually makes it with power, like Meek Mill or power, where they can have the resources and assets to look into this stuff, that's when changes are brought about. But most of these guys, you know, they just don't have the resources and power and lawyers to look into things like that, because if they did, there would be more changes. And I just agree with what you're saying. There's not many qualifications to become a correctional officer. It's kind of like the more rude you are and the more, you know, bad you treat people, you get more reputation around these guys. So it's just, it's mind blowing that the hope is just stripped from you. And I've always felt very blessed and lucky that I do have the support system, because, you know, even when you get out, I've had one allegation brought up on me, and it wasn't true. I wasn't at the right place. It wasn't just anything, but thankfully, right away, my PO told me, and I was like, listen, man, if you're going to put me in prison, you know, will you investigate in this? You know, just let me know now. I'm getting my lawyer involved. I called my lawyer. I called all my family. I called everybody that I knew, everybody in my neighborhood I knew, and, you know, if you were going to put me back in prison, this would, you know, we're going to go a long way about this, and we're going to let this be known. And thankfully, he didn't. But there's some of my best friends that have gotten out, and just by talking to a girl that knows you're on probation and, you know, you don't want to be with her, she can call your PO and actually get you put in prison. You know, what does that do for your job? Oh, you know, continuously, oh, I'm going back to prison for 3 days, for a week. They don't want to deal with that, and it just makes it harder and harder, and it's insane that some of these POs can come up to your job. I had a job, and one of my PO would come up, and they would ask, you know, who is that? Oh, that's my PO. That's just, that doesn't look good. Nobody wants that. That doesn't look good for a business or anything. So it's just mind-blowing how difficult it is. I never really realized how difficult it was getting out and all the hoops you have to jump through and all of the processes you have to go through.
I know with the probation and parole, I think myself, it does interfere too much with their lives, especially when you get a job. Some parole or probation officers want you going in every week or every couple of weeks. And I think it interferes with what you're trying to do and getting yourself established again. I don't think that parole or probation should be a thing. Maybe every 5 or 6 months just to see how you're doing. But I don't think once you serve your time in prison, I don't think that anyone should have to be going weekly or every 2 weeks to meet with the probation officer. But I wanted to say one more thing. You just mentioned that prison guard that did what he did, and he was supposed to have been fired. I've heard this from so many prisoners about these prison guards and officials that do something wrong, that get fired, and they're not really fired. They're going on to different prisons. They're moving them around from different jails and prisons, so they maintain their jobs in spite of the fact that they've committed a crime. And this really upsets me, too, because people just don't know, and the media just does not report these things. But not only are they getting jobs in other prisons, but a lot of these prison guards are related to officials, or they're related to other guards. They're bringing their friends in. They're bringing their relatives into the prisons. And you're getting the same kind of mentality overseeing the prisoners because they're all in the same family, or they're all being shifted around from one place to another. I don't think that's right either. I really don't.
I don't either. It's kind of mind-blowing how many of them, you know, are related to each other or things of that nature. And it's mind-blowing that they're able to do some of the things that they're able to do and get away with it. And it makes us, you know, makes some of us bitter, makes us, you know, dislike them. It's a hostile environment. But, you know, like I said, that's the way it is right now until, you know, we can get some changes involved. There's one of my dogs, my guard dog.
Tell them we said hello. but that's it. And it's really the way things are in the prisons today. It's just so, you know, I can see why there's so much discussion about the injustice that goes on. But I honestly wanted to say another thing. You had mentioned these suicides. I know for a fact that there have been prison guards, maybe officials too, I don't know, who have committed suicide. But I want to say there's a lot of prison guards that will be in a good relationship to understand. They interact, they relate to prisoners relate to them. And yet these are the ones that seem to be all of a sudden they're either fired or they're let go. They try to discourage prisoners and staff to be on a decent level. And this is another problem I see happening because there are so many good people in the prisons that are so afraid, once again, to go up against the prison officials, the bad ones and the bad guards.
Yes.
We see this all the time. But the thing that upsets me the most is the politicians and leadership. There was the riot that I had mentioned on our discussion yesterday, a prison riot where a few politicians went in a few times. And then they just kind of backed away and like they're not even concerned because it's not happening in their families. But I think it's very, very crucial that the people in leadership, government leaders, need to go into these prisons more often, unannounced, and actually see what's going on in the prisons. Because if they go in and speak with the prison staff, they can pretty much get an idea, especially when prisoners have information they want to share with these politicians or with these lawyers. So many prisoners have actual evidence to show what's going on in the prisons. They have actual names of prison staff that are willing to talk to these politicians. And yet these are the prisoners that politicians don't want to talk with or lawyers don't. So it's almost like giving mixed messages. Do they want to see the right things happening in the prisons, or are they trying to prevent it as well? That's what I try to figure out.
I agree. A couple of things that I can say about that is, for one, they're called tickets where I'm from. Like if you get in trouble, you can get a ticket. It's either a minor ticket or a major ticket. You know, a major ticket, you're going to end up going to segregation, and they, you know, whatever happened for you to get the major ticket, the CO or the captain writes it up, and then you see the captain, you can dispute your ticket. And one of the funniest things in there is when you dispute your ticket, you dispute it to the captain that's working at your prison. And I had a captain write my ticket. It was a false ticket. It was not true at all. And he put me in segregation, and he walked up to the cell. He gave me the ticket. He said, here's what your ticket is. And I said, it's not false. And I said, you know, what if I want to fight this? Who do I see? And he said, you see me. The same guy that wrote the ticket, he said, you see me, and you know, you can dispute it to me. And he said, just so you know, if you dispute it, I'm going to make you wait 21 days to dispute it, which they don't count towards your segregation time. So I'm sitting in there 3 weeks, 21 days, and then he hears my ticket, and he looked me in the eye and said, unless you sign this ticket, I'm going to triple it. That's what's going to happen, 100%. That's what's going to happen, and I'm going to triple it 3 months. So you're going to spend the next 4 months in segregation unless you sign it now, and I give you 2 months. And that was it. That was it. So that was that's kind of, you know, what goes on in these prisons where, you know, these COs or these sergeants, they write you tickets, and sometimes, you know, the sergeant can be the guy that you're disputing your ticket with, and it's zero hope, number one. Number two is for the correctional guard or any staff workers, I've really only met three people in the whole prison system, you know, out of 4 years that I was like, wow. You know, wow, you know, at the end of the day, I think this guy, three men that were good human beings that were, like, different. I met two correctional officers and one staff worker, which he was actually the captain's boss. He had a lot of power, and he started off as a correctional officer, and he actually helped pave the path of my prison. In the beginning, when I went up to the parole board, he actually sent me down to minimum, and I wasn't supposed to. He said, you know, he spoke up for me. He personally went to my parole hearing, and he said he hasn't done that in 5 or 6 years. And he stood up for me, and thankfully he got me moved down to a lower security prison. But he was just a different guy. He's seen you know, a lot of the prison population inmates liked him because he stood up for them. He oversaw tickets. He gave people fair chances. He didn't let you go into segregation with another cellie when he was working. So he was a good guy. But the other two correctional officers actually were fired. The other two out of the hundreds, if not, I guess, thousand that I've seen, you know, they were fired. And they were the only two ones where I was like, damn, they actually have hope. They might, you know, they made their rounds. They actually asked human beings, you know, how they were doing. You could tell that they were care. They made sure the unit, you know, like, they were different. When they came on the unit, it was weird. Everybody straightened up. Nobody broke the rules, and because they were like, they treated this guy with respect. They knew, like, you know what, as long as we just do us, as long as we follow the rules and, you know, we just do us, he's not going to make our lives more difficult. And so all the people that were on his unit respected him, even guys that were like breaking the rules or doing stuff. He wouldn't even have to say anything. The other inmates would be like, hey bro, what are you doing? You know, we got him on the shift right now. You're like, this is a good guy. You know, he's not going to sit here and write tickets. He's not going to go through our cells. And, you know, I've had my cell, you know, gone through 100 times, and I've had my TV put on the ground. I've had my whole box of food dumped over on the floor. I've written the warden about it a couple of times and nothing. And it's just nice when he comes around and they treat you with respect. They talk to the guys. They're outside of their bubble. They're making sure everything's, you know, they're doing their job. But the two other guards where I was like, where they kind of, I was really iffy with talking with them in the beginning. We're just like, wow, they're actually good human beings. And they were both fired, and you could tell all the other COs didn't like them. The other captain would come in and not talk to him. He would talk to the most meanest correctional officers and the sergeants on staff. And they basically want you to be like that. So the other two guards I've seen like that definitely were let go. And they don't like things like that. And like I said, I partially understand. I don't understand fully, but prisons are very subjective because, you know, you can't constantly say, you know, inmates and every, you know, because at the end of the day, people are broken down in different categories in prison. It's number one, you know, you have your paperwork, you have your crime that got you in a prison, you know, what you're kind of broken down to right then and there. And then you separate yourself with who you hang out with. You know, there's the young crowd, there's, you know, different gangs you can separate yourself, different, you know, races you can separate yourself, different hobbies you can separate yourself. You know, you could be a church goer, you could be an avid gym goer, you could be in the library, you could be a writer, a reader, you could spend your time walking the yard, you could spend your time never sitting on your cell. So everybody's broken down in their different categories, and it's just, you know, it's the people that, like you said, that have hope. I've met people in there that I was like, wow, you could play Division I sports, or wow, you're super knowledgeable. And it's just those people that are stripped. That's the only thing that I keep trying to advocate for prison is, I don't, I don't sit here and say that I'm bitter or that I'm like, oh, I should have never went to prison or yada yada, or I'm mad at the system for sending me in there. I just want to open up people's eyes where when I first got locked up, I was actually really against prison. I was actually really judgmental before I got locked up. I remember being 18 years old and watching the news from Milwaukee and seeing a 17-year-old black kid from the hood shoot at another guy over an argument. And the first thing they would say is, oh, his record. They would bring it up. Oh, he just got released from juvenile prison. He served 2 years in juvenile prison, and now he's facing a, first-degree reckless endangerment or something. And the first thing I would say before I was locked up, unfortunately, was like, oh, that kid doesn't learn. He didn't learn his lesson. How do you get out of prison and shoot at another guy over an argument? That doesn't even make sense. You know, you should probably lock him up and throw away the key. Until you start realizing, like, holy shit, this kid, you don't have a chance when you're locked up that young. You see the mannerisms and you see what you have to go through, and you start realizing why these kids have so much anger when they get out, and why they're so pent up, and why they don't know how to handle a situation. They can't handle an argument. You know, in prison, you don't argue. You don't sit there and talk and argue like you do out here. And you're trained a certain way in there, you know, you have to play the hand that's dealt, and then you come out here, and no matter what, it just takes time. It just takes time for a normal human being to get their mind back focused and to get their mind reintegrated in society, because there's so many norms in prison that aren't norms out here. And one of the first things that scared me is why I got dogs is I went out to the bar my first week out. I didn't drink or anything, but I just went out, and there was, you know, some drunk people that were getting involved to it with my friends, and none of my friends that I was hanging out with have ever even been in jail, let alone prison, so they all got college degrees. And they were arguing, and I was going to walk away. I was like, listen, you know, this isn't my scene, and I was going to go home. And one of the guys called my friend a bitch, and I was out a couple of days, and my mind, I was walking away, instantly went from, I was the aggressor then. I was like, what? You call my guy a bitch? I looked at my guy and said, don't worry about it. Let's whoop his ass real quick, without even thinking about it. That was just my natural reaction, because that's what you would have done in prison. Simple as that.
Yeah.
If somebody would have called you a bitch in front of people, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. You would have had to. You would have had to whoop them, and that was the norm in there. And then it made me think back, like, whoa, you know, I just almost went to prison, and I had to think that night, like, wow, you know. And it took me time. It just takes you time. And, you know, when you're in prison, the only thing you think about every day, all day, is that release date. You know, of course, you have other things on your mind. Like, you know, if you got a couple years, you're worried about this, you know, you're worried about working out first and walking the yard first. But at the end of the day, it's in everybody's mind every day. You think about that release date. You think about coming home. And when you're finally home, unfortunately, everybody expects you to be so, even my own family, you know, they just expect you to be so grateful, the most grateful human being, and kiss the ground you're on. And, you know, if anything's bothering for you, you're ungrateful or you're bitter at the world. And even my own family, when I got out of prison, I have cousins that were younger than me, and they all met me. And even a few months after being out, I would meet up with my whole family. And, you know, if my cousins were in college and they were getting B's and they had careers, my family would be like, oh, you're not doing good enough. You know, you could be doing better. And then they would come over to me, and this was my own family that supported me for 4 years. And they would say, oh, hey, how are you doing today? I'd be like, good. Do you have a job? Yes. Are you staying out of trouble? Yes. And that's all I needed to do. And they were like, wow, you're doing so good. You know, my value to bring value to this world was on such less of a spectrum, and that was with my own family. So it really opened up doors, like, how does the world think I am? All I do is need to basically be in my parents' basement, hold a full-time job, and not go back to prison, and I'm succeeding. And I was like, that's not right. You know, I can still do something important in this world. I can still become somebody. I don't just need to stay out of a box and work a minimum job and be doing good.
Yeah, and you mentioned a few times about the prisoners of color. There is a lot of biases in the prisons, I'm sure, between the whites and the blacks. But at the same time, I also notice that a lot of them do stick together in a lot of cases, because the opposition between the prison officials and guards is so bad. Sometimes it's not just affecting the people of color, it's affecting all prisoners now. But there has been, with the people of color, there's been a lot of oppression with them as well, because I have gotten that from so many clients when we had them before, and even now you hear about it. But prison oppression and abuses and deprivations and provocations, setting prisoners up, keeping them in solitary confinement, you know, depriving them of educational, medical, and psychological, and even spiritual programs or whatever. These are things that go on all the time. And we hear sometimes some of these prison officials say, oh, these guys don't want to do anything with their lives. You know, they don't want to be better themselves. They just want, they're just animals. This is so unfair for prison officials or guards to say something like this when there are so many prisoners that are trying so hard to do something, and they're being deprived of all these things. And especially those of color, I know that happens a lot with them. But now it's getting to the point where prisons are so infested with corruption, lies, and deception. And again, prisoners are filing lawsuits, and the one prisoner was put in the hole long enough for the department or the officials to have the case dismissed, the lawsuit dismissed. Once it was dismissed, they allowed that prisoner back into the to the general population. When that prisoner appealed that decision, there was a riot at the prison. And so what did they do? They targeted all prisoners after they moved the ones that started the prison riot. They targeted all the others, and one of those prisoners was the one that filed the lawsuit. To this day, and it's been almost three months now, he's still in on a restricted block or in solitary. He still doesn't have anything to read with, nothing to write with. His legal documents, they confiscated. And this is, all these legal documents had the names of prison staff that were willing to testify or willing to tell the truth. These things happen, and it's so unfair.
These things happen on a daily basis, and at the end of the day, white privilege exists. I mean, people who say it doesn't, at least I've walked in it. I'm a white human being. It exists. I mean, I have tattoos. I have a prison body, they call it, and certain things like that. But, you know, if I wear a hoodie and I'm walking around, I'm viewed different. I can speak differently. I'm viewed different. And at the end of the day, I've surrounded myself with only people of color my entire life, and it exists. There's no doubt about it, especially if you're black or Hispanic or Native, and you've been to prison. That's a double strike. At the end of the day, black people's heritage relates to slavery. You know, and that's what it goes back to. That's what it kind of started out as. And you know, at the end of the day, we got to recognize that. You know, we as far as white people, we didn't start out with slavery. We didn't. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not saying every white person has it better and there can't be white people brought up in negative neighborhoods and drug addicts and so on and so on. But at the end of the day, I've just seen it with my own eyes. I've seen people of color have it harder, have it difficult. And, you know, growing up, I didn't grow up in the hood, but going to prison, everybody grows up in the hood. You hear these stories and you hear, I still remember 18, you know, I was the youngest one in my prison. Thankfully, I went to an adult prison, so I was one of the, we have juvenile prisons in my system, two of them. So thankfully, I didn't go to the youth prison. My other co-defendants went to the youth prison, and that's just all fighting. That's no, you know, there's no leaders in there. There's no maturity. It's just, it's they call it the gladiator prison. So thankfully, I didn't have to go there, and I went to an older prison with grown men and lifers and dad. And surprisingly, the lifers were the best people and the most knowledgeable people and the most humble people. And they live through people like me that are out and have a second chance that are, you know, living out here. So it's just, but with my own eyes, it's weird to meet people where I was like, damn, this is your first time too. And they knew more lingo than me. They knew more mannerisms than me because they've seen their cousins. They've seen their brothers. They've seen their neighbors, you know, going to prison. They've already learned all the terminology. It was kind of a percentage of their life. Like growing up, most of these people knew, like, you know, they would say like, damn, I didn't think I was going to be here, but I also had a high chance. Like prison was always around them. They were always suppressed by the system. They were always harassed by the police and things of that nature where they were, it wasn't the craziest situation in the world how they're going to prison. And you should hear some of the things of why they're going to prison and things like that. It's just, it's absurd. And I've even seen it in prison. You know, racism exists, man. It just, it is what it is. And it's weird that the good people in prison get overlooked sometimes for, you know, at least in my prison, it was like the white sex offenders that were, you know, the protected people, because they would try to be good with the guards and they would have 20 years left, you know, for raping people. And they would go talk to the guards and they would tell on everybody. And those were the inmates that never had their cells searched, that were treated with respect, that, oh, how good morning are you? But it was the black guys or the Hispanic gang members that didn't talk to the correctional officers, that had, you know, violent charges, but they still had hope to go out. They were the ones leading the Bible studies. They were the ones leading the cardio classes out there. They were the ones mentoring the other inmates, the young gang members that wanted them to do something with their life, making them go to school. Those were the inmates getting their cells searched every day, getting put in segregation when they seen, oh, they're actually doing something good. That they got targeted, you know. And the same thing with me. I've had correctional officers ask me, you know, why are you hanging out with people like that? You know, we've never seen anybody of your color hang out with that group or anything like that. And it was just, it was crazy that they would even ask me that. I would just look at them and, you know, mind my own business. At the end of the day, I did me, and I don't fear any man. So at the end of the day, I was in a box, and if you want to throw me in a smaller box, I'm still going to survive. But it's just, at least my opinion for sure, I've definitely seen people of color just have it worse, you know, in every situation I've ever been in. I still feel like I have it bad. I still feel like I've been mistreated my entire life. I feel like I've been, especially when I went to prison, and especially since I've been out of prison, you know, now that I've been out 4 years, I'm starting to see some dividends. I'm starting to see people, you know, my story now starting to propel me and help me out a lot more than hurt me. But even when I got out, you know, I was looked at negative, and I've only had one altercation with the cops, and somebody called the police on me for having pit bulls at a dog park. And, you know, the cop came up right away. I was wearing a long sleeve shirt, couldn't see any tattoos. And he was like, listen, man, there's no problems here. Since you have police contact, I just got to run if you're a warrant. He didn't even ask me if I was on probation. And he was just like, I just got to run if you have a warrant. If you don't have a warrant, you're free to go. You know, you did nothing wrong, sir. Called me sir, was real nice to me. I was hanging out with a girl that had really never hung out with before. And the minute I gave her my driver's license, I told her, unfortunately, I was like, things are going to change right now. You're going to watch. And next thing you know, at a public dog park, in front of somebody's graduation, my car was surrounded by five police officers, and I ended up getting a battery. They charged me with a battery for yelling at another man for why I had pit bulls. They gave me a battery because knowing that, I should have went back to prison. And thankfully, my lawyer, I called my PO and I told him, like, listen, man, I'm getting my lawyer involved. I told him exactly what happened. And thankfully, he let me fight my case, and it got thrown out because it was so foolish. It didn't even make it to the court system. I just went into the court system or to the courthouse with my lawyer, and he had some strings, and they looked at it, and they threw it out. But things change when the police look at your record. Even in Glendale, I'm in Glendale, California now. It's a wealthy college. And I'm the captain of the soccer team. I'm the first ever mentor to ever be a part of that program, that school, that's ever been in a prison. They started a reentry program last year in 2019, and I'm the first ever mentor to mentor other students that's been incarcerated, to try to help them with school, to try to help them with resources. And after a year of being at that school, the police were even called on me when I was wearing a beater one day trying to work out, because a staff faculty member didn't think I was a student. You know, he just seen the tattoos. He seen, you know, the muscle or whatever you want to call it. And he called the police on me. And even right there, you know, that's a hostile environment. You know, I had some staff workers just telling me, hey, calm down. But police hands on their gun surrounded me in a whole campus. There was no need for that. I was wearing a beater and shorts. I had no weapons on me. My hands were showing, and they still put me up against the wall. They still told me I couldn't leave, and everything changed once I was on probation. I was walking by them, and they're like, listen, you don't have to talk to us. But the minute they found out, oh, you're on probation, now you have to talk to us. Now they're mistreating me, because they know it's my word versus their word. And at the end of the day, my word is going to amount to nothing in the system. And they definitely know that with how they act.
It reminds me of a video I saw not too long ago where this church their pastor was leaving, and he was going to be announcing the new pastor that was coming in. And while he's talking to the people in the church, this man comes in. He's all rugged with whiskers and a beat-up old suit, and he goes to sit down next to one of the parishioners, and they move away. They get up and move away, and everybody's staring him down and looking at him, and is, you know, like, what's this man doing in our church? And it was just going on. The pastor was going on talking about the new pastor that's going to be taking over. And you probably know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
When he gets ready to introduce the new pastor, it's the very person that walked in with his face all uncleansed and the suit on. He looked like a homeless person. And that was the pastor going in. But they were just testing to see what the people, these so-called righteous people, were going to do.
Yes.
When this person came in, and this is exactly what happened. They looked down at this man like he hadn't done anything wrong, but he was different looking than them. So they just looked down on him like he was some kind of a nobody, and that was the person of God that was going to be preaching to them about all of these things in the Bible, including Moses, King David, and the Apostle Paul, who was once Saul, all murderers. He was going to be talking about the prostitute that they wanted to stone. He was going to be preaching all these things that are in the Bible that these people were going to be hearing about eventually. And they were looking down on him like he was nobody. So the goal is to show you that sometimes people, they judge without even knowing. They claim to be Christians, and yet they look at people in a different light when they're not like them, or when they have done something wrong like yourself. And I'll tell you, Thomas, you are so full of wisdom for your age. You are so full of wisdom. You're non-biased. And it says in the Bible, 1 John 4:20, chapter 4, verse 20, anyone that says they love God whom they cannot see, how can they hate a brother or sister whom they can see? So there's so many things people really need to look at when they judge.
I agree. And, you know, like I said, going through a situation like this, I didn't always have the confidence I had. I had a lot of doubts, you know, facing these years in prison. You know, I was a superstar in high school. I walked around not like I was better than everybody. I treated everybody equal, even the underdogs. I've always stood up for the underdogs. But I walked around with confidence. I always knew I was important. I always knew I was put on this earth to help people. But when you're down and out facing all these years in prison, you don't know what's going to happen. You question yourself. You question, wow, you know, am I really this person I want to be? And the big thing that hit me was my church right away. I went to a Catholic church. I was brought up Catholic. I was an altar boy. And my family was kind of religious, but church has always stuck with me. I didn't really have a male role model my whole life. My whole life growing up, I never had somebody older put their hand around my shoulder and really teach me things. It was always me and learning on my own and me making my own decisions. Until I went to prison, I finally had mentors. But it hit me hard because I went to the same church my whole life, and I had teachers that went to this church, and I had my athletic director that went to this church. And it was crazy that when I was going to school, high school, I was a star athlete, and, you know, I would get in trouble if I got in a fight for sticking up for, you know, a bully or something like that. And he would still let me play soccer. He still needed me. I was a good soccer player, so he would overlook certain things, and he would treat me all nice. And all of a sudden, when I caught my case right after high school, I went back to high school, and I asked them, you know, for letters of recommendations and certain things, and there were a few people that would not speak to me, that told me not to come back, don't talk to them. And these were all people at my church that when I walked into my church, I seen them. And these were people that actually not only went to my church, they would stand up in my church. They would be the ones handing out the bread and wine. And one day I went and I talked to my priest because I was leaving my church. And I was like, I can't do this. You know, it bothers me that I know like five people personally that come to this church. I see them get on their knees. I see them pray. And they won't write me a letter. I've never done anything wrong to them. They know who I am. They've known me for years. They've known me since I was, you know, 15, 14, 13 years old. And they don't want to talk to me because they think I'm a horrible human being. And my priest made a mass for me. And he opened up the community's eyes. That's what really started opening up. And I started going to a Christian church of another the pastor. It was the first time ever going to a Christian church. He did a mass for me. And I had a lot of people reach out to me. Thankfully, you know, a couple of them still didn't. they still went to church, but it was mind blowing that it was these people that went to church that would frown upon me and wouldn't look at me when they seen me in the community. They wouldn't speak to me. So I understand how that goes, but at the end of the day, in any situation, if you want to talk about the people that won't look at you, that you expect to be there, well, guess what? You know, there's going to be people that you don't expect to be there that's going to look at you. And that's what really changed my life, is these people I didn't know about that heard me out on bail and my volunteer. You know, they saved my life. They helped me out, because these were people that didn't know me, that just seen me, and that knew that I was facing 130 years in prison and still took a chance on me. Didn't know me from Adam and Eve, and still took a chance on me, and still made a huge impact in my life. I had people that I never met until I got in trouble, and they reached out to me. They wrote letters on my behalf. They stuck with me.
We're running out of time. I would like to have you back next week if possible. You are just so interesting, and if possible, maybe next Thursday morning.
Yeah, that's
same
fine.
Time.
With this quarantine, I'm at home. Yes.
Okay, I will check with you in between. But in the meantime, thank you so much for being on with us. We just ran out of time. And again, I'll send you the schedule for next Thursday, maybe around the same time.
Perfect. Thanks for having
okay.
me
on. Okay. I'll tell you, you are just amazing. I am so honored to have met you and on the radio and the show. And I will definitely have you back on next week. And I'm going to be talking to some others, because they have radio shows on the Facebook and elsewhere. And I'm going to see about having you on their shows too. One of these days I can see you being on CNN News in one of those places. You just have so much wisdom and so much knowledge of what's going on in the world. And I appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. I'll see you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.